does one follow that? Thank you so much, George Galloway. The only small thing I would say is that I feel that it's imperative that each and every one of us take this candle that has been lit from these words, take them back to your circles, to your unions, to your workplaces, to everywhere. Build the movement. It's our responsibility, each and every one of us. We are going to take a few questions. We'd like to present George Galloway with a token of our appreciation, and I'd also like to acknowledge some folks that are here tonight. So first of all, I just want to say that we're very proud to have here among us this evening members of the U.S. War Resisters. We have Phil McDowell and his wife, Jameen, Bill Hart, Stephanie and Chris Teske, and they're all here. Wahid Vellante, the National Vice President of the Canadian Islamic Congress. Thank you for being here. I also see John Cartwright, the President of the Toronto and North Labour Council. Thank you for being here, John. Got a broad group of people there to bring your message back to. I hope I'm not missing anyone else. All of you are special, and everyone is welcome. So, we will take questions, and we don't have a floor mic, so I would encourage you to raise your hands. I think we can take between 6 and 8 questions, maximum. We'd ask you to limit your question to a minute. And I think the best thing to do is raise your hands, and I will repeat your question. And then, George, if you would, come up to the mic and answer them. So I see a question here. And we'll do this one by one.
Mr. Galloway, I have a new title for you. I'm going to give you the title of Commander-in-Chief of Peace.
Thank you, sir.
And having given you the title, I would like you to reflect as to what role countries like India, who are often depicted and mentioned as the largest Western style of democracy, which is also full of non-democracy. I would like you to render your observation on Indian side of democracy.
So we do want to try to keep it short. This question was simply about the role of India and to reflect upon that. That was really a short version. I'm sure George will enlighten us. Next question, please. Nice and loud. To comment on what's happening in Darfur. And one more. A message for the youth. Okay.
Well, I declare an interest in doing so, especially as I see people leaving. Let me start with the last question. Because one of the things that I touched on earlier in my remarks was the extent to which the landscape has been transformed by the new technology and the new age in which we live. Just a little while ago, my Sky News interview would have been seen by just the 40,000 people who are watching it on that Sunday morning, instead of by tens of millions of people. And the reason is the internet, the reason is YouTube, and the reason is the email abilities that most of us, and especially young people, almost all young people in the developed world have. And that transforms the landscape, frees us from the tyranny of the Conrad Blacks and the Rupert Murdochs and all the owners of the mind-numbing mediocrity that passes for the mass media in our countries. Now, I have an interest in this. I'm on this fundraising tour. I wouldn't like you to think that any of the money from these meetings is going to me personally. We are trying to develop internet television. We want to have an internet TV for rebels like us all over the world, so that every day we can speak to each other. I can speak to you, you can speak to me. And as you're leaving, we're asking you to make donations to that internet TV, and I hope that you'll do so quietly with folding money rather than coins, because it will disturb the rest of my answers if you're leaving earlier. That, I have a website, georgegalloway.com. 500,000 people have read, gone to it in just a couple of months. And there are hundreds of others, sites of progressive people all over the world. And we must communicate with each other and can communicate with each other like lightning, mobilizing each other, informing each other, educating each other, agitating each other, organizing each other. We can do that now in a way that simply was not possible when the older activists, including me, spent most of the days of their youth. Now, of course, the key point is, what is democracy? It would take me too long to develop all of my arguments about this, but I'm going to say something which might not meet with the favor of everyone present. I've just written a book about Fidel Castro. I've just been in Cuba. That's why I've got this beard. It's not a Nasrallah beard, it's a Castro beard. Cuba doesn't have a democracy like the one they have in Florida. That's true. Doesn't have a democracy where, to stand for president with a chance of winning, you have to raise and spend $1 billion in a fight between Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Cuba doesn't have that kind of democracy, that's true. Partly because it's been under siege for 4 decades, nearly 5, from the most powerful so-called democracy in the world. But democracy is about outcome as well as process. In Cuba, all the children who are born will have a doctor free of charge, will be more likely to survive their birth than a child born in the United States, will live a longer life than a child born in the United States, will have a free school, primary, secondary, university, will have access to culture and sport without money, in a way that people in democracies will not have. So we mustn't get ourselves hung up on this question that everybody in the world has to have a Westminster-style parliament with two cheeks of the same arse sitting opposite each other, asking you to put an X on the ballot paper just once every 5 years and calling that democracy. That's not the only kind of democracy that we can have. I'm going to tell you something about Darfur, you might not like it. The United States is trying to develop a drive to war against Sudan, not because of the problems that exist in Darfur, to which I shall return. The United States hates Sudan because its government is not a slave to them. Because Sudan has developed a gigantic oil and gas field as big as, if not bigger than, even Saudi Arabia and Iraq itself. Even worse, Sudan has already entered into a contract with China to sell all its oil to China. And the United States wants regime change in Khartoum, not for Darfur, but so it can scrap the contract with China and secure those oil supplies for themselves. That's why the propaganda which has been mounted against Sudan echoes so clearly the propaganda offensives against other countries described by Bush and Blair and others as rogue states. I have a radio show every Saturday and Sunday night between 8 and 10 London time. You can listen to it on the internet through talksport.net. Between 3 and 5 your time on Saturdays and Sundays. I get people phoning me up. They think that the conflict in Darfur is between Muslims and Christians. There are no Christians in Darfur. They think it's a conflict between Africans and Arabs. But all Sudanese are Africans. They think it's a linguistic conflict. But everybody in Darfur speaks Arabic. They think it's about Muslims versus other religions, but all of the people in Darfur are Muslims, 98.4% of them. So they think maybe it's Sunni and Shia, but all of the Muslims in Darfur are Sunni Muslims. This is a conflict centuries old between nomadic people and pastoral people over land. It's a complex, sensitive conflict which needs to be resolved, which is causing great suffering. But it will not be resolved by George Bush and his army invading Sudan.
Okay, three more. Some fellows up there. Okay, views on what's happening in Lebanon and what might happen.
Your spirit words reminded me of the brother from Venezuela who spoke in the United Nations.
First of all, that I don't. So write to me at georgegalloway.com and enlighten me on the situation in Guyana. Let me start with Hugo Chavez. I believe that the revolution that's going on in Latin America, which reached another high point, not as high as it might once have been, but a high point nonetheless, with the victory of Daniel Ortega and the Sandinista Front in the election of Nicaragua, is directly linked to the events I'm describing in Iraq and in the Middle East. You see, the attack on Iraq was supposed to show, was supposed to terrorize the world with American power. But in fact, what it has demonstrated is not the extent of American power, but the limits of American power, and it has thus emboldened people everywhere to stand up to American imperialism, not the least in Latin America. And it's got to the stage where you cannot win an election in Latin America unless you say that you're a friend of Fidel Castro and an enemy of George W. Bush. Except in Peru and Mexico, if you can steal the election by fraud. I was in New York, last time I was in New York, Hugo Chavez came to New York. The American government, North American government, United States government, I must get this nomenclature right, the United States government refused Chavez security detail visas. So he arrived in the United States without any security protection. And he went to speak at a church. This, by the way, was the week after the president's personal pastor, Pat Robertson, had publicly stated that Chavez should be murdered. Chavez went to speak at a church in the Bronx. Tens of thousands of people came to hear him. He didn't need a single security guard. Chavez doesn't need security anywhere in the world. If Hugo Chavez or Fidel Castro came to any big city in the world, millions would turn out to hear them. When George Bush turns up in any capital city in the world, you need millions of policemen and soldiers to guard them from the anger of the population. Now, the situation in Lebanon is very, very delicate and tense and dangerous. And I don't want to say things that make the situation worse. But there are certain truths that have to be faced by the Lebanese supporters of the current Lebanese government, which is openly threatening Hezbollah with disarming and all sorts of other things. When the so-called Cedar Revolution took to the streets of Lebanon, they said that they were fighting for democracy. But if there was democracy in Lebanon, Hassan Nasrallah would be the president of the country. You can't be the president because you have to be a Christian to be the president. And the power that these Cedar revolutionists were defending was not democratic power, but sectarian power, where on an entirely false analysis of the population of Lebanon, Christian power is enshrined on the basis of a percentage of the population which ceased to exist 50 years ago. In Lebanon now, the Shiites are the biggest part of the population, but they had only 2 members in the cabinet. General Michel Aoun represents perhaps 70% of the Christians and doesn't have any seats in the cabinet. And so there is an alliance between the Hezbollah and its allies, Amal, and the Christian forces supporting General Aoun for a new government, a real government of national unity. And I support that demand. It's being refused by the United States-backed government because they want to use Lebanon as a knife to stick in the back of Syria. That's the purpose of the Lebanese government. Let me tell you that when I went to visit the Prime Minister of Lebanon in August of this year, as soon as I came in the door, before he even said hello, and I've known him 20 years, he said, "Stop saying that we won the war. We lost the war and now we must pay the price." I told him, "Prime Minister, I'm used to Arab leaders who lose wars and pretend that they won them. I've never known an Arab leader to win a war and pretend that he lost it." because he's sorry that he won it. Because he wants to pay the price. And that price is to serve American and Israeli interests in the country and in the region. Lebanon is a beautiful place, a wonderful country, with fantastically entrepreneurial cultures, enthusiastic, energetic, hardworking people. It deserves better than that which it has suffered these last decades. But it will not achieve what it should achieve by attempting to export itself out of the Arab world. Lebanon is an Arab country. It's an Arab country which was once part, as the other countries in the Levant were, of one land, the land of Sham, the land of Syria. To pretend that Lebanon can opt out of its history and its geography, which is the stand of the pro-American government as now in Lebanon, is simply unrealistic. I believe that if a national unity government is not formed soon, and I mean in the next few days, that millions of people will take to the streets of Lebanon to bring this government down. And so they should.
Thank you very much.
Involved in issues related to Palestine for many years, and I
to answer a question from you. It would take me longer than we have to fully develop the reasons for the foundation of the State of Israel and its role vis-a-vis the imperialist powers. But I'll do my best to summarize it thus. In the building in which I work and have sat for 20 years, that's my musical accompaniment. In the building I have sat for 20 years as a member of the British Parliament, I pass every day the room in which the British Minister, Mr. Balfour, authored this entire tragedy. When, on behalf of one people, he promised a second people the land belonging to a third people and sent everyone down this bloody staircase that we've been descending ever since. Now, as part of the point I made earlier, Mr. Balfour didn't make this declaration because he liked Jews. As a matter of fact, he hated Jews. He was a notorious anti-Semite, and one of the reasons he wanted the people to whom he made the promise to go and live in the land of a third people was so that he would never have to look at their face again. That's a fact. But secondly, he didn't consult any of the three people involved. He didn't ask the British, who in any case had an extremely restricted franchise at the time, whether they wanted to be the author of this crime. Secondly, the people to whom he promised the land not only did not represent the Jewish people at that time, they represented a tiny fragment of the Jewish people at that time. When that promise was made in 1917, the Jews in the world were the advance guard, the avant-garde of everything good in the world, at the head of every progressive movement in the world, every socialist, every communist, every trade union, every movement for liberty was led by Jews. This is a very important thing to know. Zionism, and that was who he was making the promise to, represented a tiny handful in 1917 of the Jews. And of course, the people least consulted of all were the people whose land it was that he was giving away. Now, why did he do it? He did it for the same reason as empires always seek to divide and rule. He wanted a settler state implanted in the Arab world to keep the Arabs divided and weak so that imperialism could steal their things. And it worked beautifully, because in another room in the same building where I work, Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, the English and French Foreign Office officials, with their maps and their pencils, drew on the map of the Arab world the 23 totally artificial mini-states that they created at the same time, and plotted which corrupt kings, later which puppet presidents, to move around the chessboard and put them in charge, to keep the Arabs divided and weak so the West could steal their things. And what a successful policy that has been. And here I need to make this point, because there are many people, including some Arabs, who imagine that America works for Israel, who think that there's some conspiracy going on, that the Americans are somehow blinded. If we could only waken them up, if we could only make the scales fall from their eyes, they would see Israel in a different light and change their policy towards it. America doesn't work for Israel. Israel works for America. Israel carries out America's policy in the Arab world. It's vital that you know that, otherwise you go looking for Jews, you see. You go looking for how many Jews are in the Congress, how many Jews are in the cabinet, How many Jews own newspapers in the United States? If only. It's vital to know that Israel's job is to do the kind of things it did in Lebanon just a matter of a few short months ago. And its job is given to it by the imperial powers, first Britain and France, and then the United States of America later. Now, the young woman asked about the death sentence on Saddam. As it happens, I'm against the death penalty for anybody, always. Nothing, it seems to me, could demean a state more than placing a rope around someone's neck in cold blood and killing them. This is merely judicial state murder, and I'm against it for everyone at all times. Now, if Saddam Hussein had fallen in the war to the people of Iraq, nobody could have complained, least of all him. He killed a lot of people. If someone had killed him, it would have made a certain sense of symmetry and justice. But the one group of people not entitled to put Saddam Hussein on trial are the criminals who invaded and occupied the country and installed a puppet regime in Baghdad. And if you thought it was an Iraqi trial, you obviously missed the fact that they brought in the verdict of hanging 2 days before the American midterm elections to try and help George Bush survive the beating that he ultimately suffered. Another dead body won't solve anything in Iraq. Killing Saddam Hussein will not solve any problem. It will make every problem worse. First of all, most of the people fighting the occupation in Iraq are not fighting for Saddam Hussein. And so they're not going to stop fighting because we killed him. Those who are fighting for Saddam Hussein, and there's rather more of them than we were told at the time, will not stop fighting because we killed him. They'll fight harder because we killed him. And lastly, and most importantly, the killing of Saddam Hussein will deepen, perhaps permanently, the chasm between Sunni and Shiite Muslims in Iraq, which has been opened up by this war and by this occupation. So my advice, if anyone's listening, is don't do it. It would be a very big mistake. Now, I have to answer bluntly on the question of the United Nations. Lenin called the League of Nations, the predecessor of the United Nations, a thieves' kitchen. And I believe that the United Nations is a thieves' and beggars' kitchen, where the thieves make the decisions and the beggars vote for them in return for some of the crumbs off the table. And if, for a combination of reasons, the United Nations beggars refuse to vote for the decisions of the thieves go outside and do it anyway. That's exactly what happened in Iraq. Exactly what happened in Yugoslavia, and it will happen again elsewhere. The United Nations has been fatally undermined by the way that Britain and America behaved in the run-up to the Iraq war. A United Nations where you get a permanent seat and a veto because you've got a nuclear weapon when you're going around the world threatening other people that you'll invade them if they try to get a nuclear weapon. What kind of justice? What kind of symmetry is that? How can you have a Security Council where India, with 1 billion people, is not on it? Where Germany is not on it? Where Latin America is not on it? Where there's no Arab country except every blue moon, not on it? Such a Security Council renders the United Nations a farce. If we had a really democratic United Nations, where the General Assembly was the parliament, which elected a Security Council, chose a general secretary and could sack the general secretary. That would be something worth having. But we don't have it. And so I tell you candidly, if the thieves had managed to blackmail, bully, browbeat a majority of the Security Council to vote for the invasion of Iraq, it would still have been a crime. It would still have been utterly illegitimate, and I would still have opposed it. Now lastly, because I'm running out of voice, and I've got to be on TV at 6:25 tomorrow morning. 6:15, I'm told. Canadian TV. CTV News Net. They'll show it throughout the day. Don't get up early just to see it. Of course it's true that most of the dead Iraqis were killed by Bill Clinton. I met Bill Clinton once. He asked me if we'd met before. I said, no, but you killed some friends of mine. One of them was the greatest woman painter in the Arab world, Leila Al-Attar, who was killed by a cruise missile, which landed on her house and killed her, her children, her domestic staff, blinded her husband. It was fired on their house to divert attention from a stain on Monica Lewinsky's dress, and for no other reason. That's what happened. Don't forget it. An aspirin factory in Sudan was destroyed on the same day for exactly the same purpose. How low can you get to kill people to divert attention from a personal scandal in which you are enveloped? So nobody needs to tell me about the Democrats. But although it would not solve everything to get rid of George W. Bush, it wouldn't be a bad start, would it? It wouldn't be a bad start. And of course, the forces, the dynamics that are driving the Republican Party to defeat inevitably will bring the Democrats into power. But if we develop those forces and those dynamics powerfully enough, they must ineluctably drive the Democrats to a different foreign policy position, or they will face the same fate. You see, people say to me, what difference will it make Mr. Blair going and being replaced by Mr. Brown? Well, on the face of it, nothing. But just getting rid of Mr. Blair doesn't guarantee that we can get a change of line. But you can guarantee that unless you get rid of Mr. Blair, you will never get a different line. And the same is true in the politics of the United States. Thank you very much.